You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Charlie Ebinger, the director of the Energy Security Initiative here at Brookings, and we are particularly delighted today to have such a distinguished panel with us to talk about the implications of the U.S. unconventional hydrocarbon renaissance and potential impact on Japan. Of course, a vital ally. All of us would, of course, like to the degree possible, if we had control, to make sure that our hydrocarbon revolution helps the Japanese. But of course, these are determined by market issues and private sector concerns. But we're here with a very distinguished panel. I'm only going to introduce them very briefly, because you have their bios, I believe, in your packets. Is that right, Alyssa? Everybody has bios? But truly, we have a tremendous array of expertise represented on the stage today. We're going to commence with Mike Herberg, who is, of course, a research director of the National Bureau of Research's Energy Security Program, who has many, many years dealing with Asian energy issues and many years in successively important positions at ARCO, which, of course, going back to some of the early interests in Alaskan energy for Japan, I know Mike was deeply involved in those. He is a frequent correspondent in a number of journals and newspapers and is quoted extensively throughout the energy trade press, always on energy issues. He's going to be followed by Jim Jensen, who, of course, is one of the leading energy economists, particularly given his well-known expertise on liquefied natural gas issues, not only in Asia, where he is indeed an expert, but also the rest of the world. As I always say, since Mr. Jensen was particularly nice to me when I was a budding young scholar, I don't want to tell you how many years ago that was, but he is well-known, participates in many activities at the Oxford Energy Institute and throughout the world. And as I always like to say, Mr. Jensen has forgotten more about LNG than most of us have ever known, and has particularly insightful views on what's going on in Japan. He will be followed in turn by Mr. Muramatsu, who is the general manager of the Washington office of the Japan Oil, Gas, and Minerals National Corporation, or JOGMEC, and that was, of course, formed in 2004 with the merging of the former Japan National Oil Companies with the former Metal Mining Agency of Japan. He has served as counselor of Japan's permanent mission to the European Union and as director of the European Division at the Trade and Policy Bureau for METI. And he is extremely well known in not only, obviously, Japan, but throughout the United States and major oil and gas producing regions. And finally, we will turn to Soichi Ito, who is the manager and senior analyst at the Institute for Energy Economics. Soichi is a longstanding friend of the Brookings Institution, having served a stint here with us and also at our sister institution, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, prior to joining IEEJ. He has served in a number of important positions in the Japanese government and is well known on energy forums relating to Japan throughout the world. And is also, I should mention, since I share his view, a sterling believer that Alaska needs to play a much more important role in our bilateral relations going down the road. The forum will be that each speaker will try to limit to 15 minutes, hopefully. So we have plenty of time for questions. I will then ask just one or two questions to get the discussion going, and we want to hear from the floor at that point. So, Mike, you want to go first?
Thank you, Charlie, for that kind introduction, you know. Some of us, if we hang around long enough, even I can become respectable if you hang around long enough. There's a more colorful saying like that, but I won't use that with this distinguished audience. Thank you for inviting me to speak to such an interesting group and on such a very distinguished panel. Charlie asked if I would confine myself really to the oil side of the equation, the unconventional boom, and what it means for Asia and Japan. So I'll try to stay in my lane and leave the LNG issues to Jim. I think the broad statement would be that in the oil side, in a very indirect and in some ways direct way, the U.S. Oil production boom has been enormously beneficial for Asia, broadly Asia's energy security, and obviously specifically for Japan's energy security. It's a bit indirect, and as we all know, the U.S. doesn't export crude. We export product, but we can't export crude, so there's no direct flows of crude oil towards Asia or towards Japan. But in indirect ways, in terms of a global market for oil, this enormous binge of production from the U.S. oil side has been broadly beneficial for Japan and Asia, I think, in terms of energy security. It's worthwhile to think of three groups of countries in Asia when you think about this. The deep importers that import virtually all their oil and gas and to some extent coal, that's Japan, South Korea, Taiwan. Obviously, they're going to benefit enormously from anything that adds oil supplies to the marketplaces, to the marketplace and keeps oil prices from rising too high. So those are the most direct beneficiaries of this. Then you've got the producer importer side, and that would include obviously China and to some extent India. China, of course, benefits on the oil side as well. It may benefit on the gas and LNG side as well. We'll have to wait and see on that. But I think China benefits from the on the oil side. They're the biggest oil importer from the Middle East. I think now they're the largest oil importer in the world, according to some of the latest statistics, surpassing the U.S. So anything that adds supplies to that global oil marketplace and keeps prices down is beneficial to the Chinese. The other side I'll leave to Jim, but the gas LNG exporters in the Asia region, Russia, Australia, Southeast Asia, you know, it's a different picture for them, all this potential LNG coming out of the U.S., but as I said, I'll leave that to Jim. I think the oil market benefits show up pretty early. In other words, we're seeing the benefits for Asia and Japan already. On the shale gas side, I think the benefits are much a little further down the road. We have some immediate benefits. So we're exporting cheap gas to Europe in the form of coal, cheap coal already. So the molecules are going. They're just a lot dirtier. So I think there are immediate benefits, but I think the shale benefits for Asia tend to take a while to show up. So let's talk specifically about the oil side. Japan, South Korea, all heavily oil import dependent. And when you look at the incremental production in the U.S., the numbers are truly staggering, the incremental addition to the global market. U.S. incremental oil production has risen 3.5 million barrels a day since 2008. This year it's risen by 1 million barrels a day, according to the latest EIA data. They're expecting another 1 million barrels a day increase next year and another 700,000 or 800,000 barrel a day increase in production in 2015. But even as we speak, 2008 to 2013, 3.5 million barrels a day of incremental crude supply in the marketplace. So that has offset an enormous set of problems with production from a whole set of other countries. I mean, you've added the equivalent of Iraq or Iran to global production, second largest producers within OPEC incremental production. So, I mean, that's a huge incremental addition to the marketplace. That's helping offset very low growth in non-OPEC oil supplies over the last 5 years outside of North America. Very disappointing results in terms of increases in non-OPEC supply. It's helping offset production problems in a whole series of places. Within OPEC, obviously, you've got reduced exports from Iran of about 1 million barrels a day because of the sanctions. You have security problems and conflicts. Iraq, Nigeria, Libya. You go down the list, there's a couple million barrels a day nearly of OPEC production that's not online because of these various conflicts. You look over the non-OPEC side, you've got a whole set of production problems in another set of countries, Sudan, Syria, Egypt, Yemen, production offline. When you add all that offline production, you've got about 3 million barrels a day of supplies that aren't in the marketplace. And you wash that up against the incremental 3.5 million barrels a day that you've seen come out of the U.S. in the last several years. If the U.S. had not added that 3.5 million barrels a day to the marketplace, essentially the whole 92 million barrel a day world oil system would have to be running flat out to meet consumption. So that incremental U.S. supply has been the difference between a tight market and an absolutely taut market, which where the price would have been, I'd be willing to bet, significantly higher than $100 to $110 a barrel. So in that indirect way, Japan in particular has benefited, but all the big oil importers in Asia have benefited. If you go out over time, look at the spare capacity in the OPEC-producing countries. Spare capacity today stands at about 3 million barrels a day. Again, if you hadn't had that 3.5 incremental production from the U.S., the market simply would not be at $110 a barrel or $100 a barrel. It would be much, much higher. And I think if you look out over the long term, as this U.S. production continues to come online for the next several years, at least in the current forecast, trailing off as you head past 2015, the increase is trailing off. This is going to put a cap on demand for OPEC oil as we go forward. The quota is sitting at 30 million barrels a day. OPEC will probably have to cut production a little bit this year to sustain that price level that they're looking for. And if you go further out, you know, this extra U.S. oil production is really putting a cap on OPEC's market share and the incremental call on OPEC oil and helping keep a lid on prices over the next several years. And I think this is one of the key reasons the U.S. oil production would be one of the key reasons why most analysts, I think, are expecting there to be, you know, disregarding security issues in a variety of places, the pressure on oil prices to tend to be somewhat downward. So I'd argue for Japan, this has been an enormous benefit. When the Fukushima loss of the nuclear power capacity, Japan's oil imports have risen by about 150,000 barrels a day. When you look at the incremental cost of that, and if you added a premium onto oil prices that we would have had without this incremental U.S. production, you can think about the excruciating costs of that. So I think broadly speaking, it's pretty good for Japan and pretty good for Asia, adding all this oil to this big global market. Let me make one final comment on another side of the issue that may not be quite so bright. And that is if you imagine that this gradual trends towards U.S. quasi-self-sufficiency in oil, natural gas exports, and I say quasi-self-sufficiently, it's a perception issue. And you add that to strategic kind of security considerations that suggests that it will be more and more difficult for the U.S. to sustain its deep level and costly level of engagement in the Middle East and Persian Gulf. And the perception domestically that, well, we're pretty well supplied, maybe we don't have to necessarily carry that heavy load of protecting the Persian Gulf oil producers, the Arab oil producers, the sea lanes, maybe we shouldn't necessarily be carrying that heavy a load, essentially the sole role in enhancing the security of that flow of oil, which essentially all goes to Asia now. If that were to lead the U.S. to draw back a bit on its engagement in the Middle East, what does this mean for Asia? What does this mean for Japan, whose lifeline of energy supplies coming from the Middle East to Asia and Japan, 90-95% of Japan's oil supplies coming from Gulf suppliers. What does this mean for Asia's energy security? And how do we think about the future in which maybe Japan and the rest of the big Asian importers need to think about carrying something more of that load of ensuring the flow of oil from the Persian Gulf to Asia? How do we craft that kind of a set of arrangements given the overlay of strategic mistrust in the region. So I think this is a part of that production boom that may not necessarily be quite as beneficial, benign for Asia, as the production effects of all that extra oil supply coming out of the U.S. So that, let me finish and let Jim talk about the LNG side, the really fun part of this.
While Jim is making his way to the podium, I neglected to mention two things, and I apologize. One is that this, for those of you that are on Twitter, this is being, you can follow this on Japan Energy all together. And I also was remiss in not noting that we are very pleased and honored to have Mr. Nobuo Tanaka, former director of the International Energy Agency, with us today.
Okay. Charlie, thank you for the very kind introduction. I'm going to pitch in on the gas side. And really, security of supply and gas really is about price. So you're going to hear me talking very much about price. I assume, without my glasses, I need to find where the shift is here. Hang on. Page down. There we go. Oh, good. All right. Great. Okay. Since the 2009 recession, Japan has been increasingly forced to face severe challenges to its energy and environmental policies. The Fukushima disaster in March 2011 placed the future of nuclear power under a cloud and has led to a policy which, in theory, is going to call for the phase-out of all nuclear plants over a period of time. Then, after years of debate about the carbon issue, in October 2012, Japan finally addressed the carbon emissions issue by introducing a phased-in carbon tax. Thus, those two policies hit at what were the basis of power generation in Japan, baseload coal and nuclear. And essentially, they were baseload LNG up to that point because of its higher cost had been used for intermediate firing. While these policies may not survive the recent change in government, they imply greater reliance on LNG-fired power generation and advanced coal technology. LNG had accounted for only 28% of generation in 2009. Non-hydro renewables were only 3%. Because of its higher costs, LNG has historically been relegated to intermediate firing. Pre-Fukushima, its market share never exceeded 28%. Gas had an even lower industrial share, 9% to coal's 30%. But just as Japan is attempting to place greater emphasis on more expensive gas, LNG costs have been rising substantially. Import prices in 2012 were at an all-time high. Thus, the appeal of importing LNG from the U.S. for the development of shale gas has driven gas prices to levels not seen since the 1990s. The post-Fukushima shutdown of nuclear generation forced a large increase in LNG imports. While a decline in total required generation and increases in oil firing partially offset the loss between 2009 and 2012, gas-fired generation still accounted for 44% of the total replacement. This led to a 36% increase in Japanese LNG imports. Nearly 90% of it was the responsibility of the electric side, not the gas utilities. Japan also had to cope with declining availability from Indonesia, which has supply problems. While increases in long-term contracts with Australia, Qatar, and Sakhalin helped, the demand uncertainties forced Japan to utilize short-term imports, accounting for 62% of the increase. And here simply shows the balance of difference in generation stated in gas equivalents between 29 and 2012. And as you can see, the increase in LNG imports was a substantial part of that. And this simply shows you the makeup of the supply, the loss of the Indonesian volumes, the increase in the contracts, but the reliance on spot imports, both from those who have contracts with Japan and from countries that don't. For example, Africa, all over the world was shipping to Japan. The 2009-2010 gas market surplus set off regional gas price competition and forced a possibly permanent restructuring of the international gas pricing system. For some time, it's been common among energy analysts to speculate that growing LNG trade would finally create a world gas market by linking previously isolated regional markets. The LNG surplus of 2009-2010 finally made it happen. But the result bears very little resemblance to the relatively uniform regional price structure of the world oil market. As a result of the surplus, international gas prices are experiencing unprecedented divergence. Got a slide out of order here. The restructuring puts great stress on finding ways to reduce the cost of imported Asian LNG in order to maintain industrial competitiveness. Much of the interest in U.S. LNG exports is based on the huge disequilibrium between U.S. commodity prices and the European and Asian contract prices, which have been oil-linked. It's been possible to talk of world oil prices because the costs of marine transportation are relatively low. Same is true for coal. But one cannot talk about world gas prices because gas, like those legendary local French wines, does not travel well. Thus, LNG importing countries will always have higher prices than exporting countries. And this simply shows you an example of transportation costs as a function of distance, LNG in pipelines. LNG, you have to pay to liquefy it and regasify it regardless of the distance it goes. Once you put it on a tanker, it can go a long distance. Pipelines are pretty costly for moving any distance, and economies of scale are very important in pipeline economics. Prices have been driven by different forces in each of the four markets. The full effect of the U.S. shale gas surplus began to make itself felt in mid-2008, and Henry Hub prices fell. But the oil-linked continental and Asian contract prices were driven by oil prices, first rising, then briefly falling, and then rising again. Europe has now partially adapted to commodity competition. Traditionally, the typical Japanese formula provided a higher price level for a given level of oil prices than the European one. For a time, this Asian premium was partly offset by price capping clauses called S-curves, but many of these have now been eliminated in the tight market. Dutch TTF, which represents continental pricing, was first influenced by weak LNG prices, but later, as the market tightened, it was influenced by continental oil-linked prices. And this simply shows the way the price structure of four different things, Henry Hub, the TTF, the Dutch price, which is half commodity and half contract, the German when we had the German in and the Russian prices, or the Japanese and the Russian prices to the Germans. And you can see they've blown apart because of what has been happening. A legitimate question, what might a theoretical world commodity gas market look like? People who like to do world gas models assume that supply, demand, and price will set commodity prices. But this isn't quite the same thing. One can devise an equilibrium set of price differentials based between markets, assuming that transportation alone sets the regional price differences for the commodity. Alone among the major LNG trading partners, North America has a truly gas-to-gas competitive commodity market. While the UK also has a competitive commodity market, it tends to be influenced by continental oil linkage when LNG markets are tight. Thus, this equilibrium theoretical pricing system might be based on Henry Hub pricing. And although it lacks the liquidity and transparency of Henry Hub, Qatar plays a similar hub role in LNG, since it can arbitrage Atlantic and Pacific basin prices. In such a theoretical system, the European gas value might be based on U.S. prices plus the cost of transportation from the U.S. Gulf Coast to Europe. Then these prices might be netted back to Qatar, where they would in turn establish equilibrium Asian prices. The following figure is just such an estimate. The equilibrium transportation differential between the U.S. and Europe for 2012 is $5.21. And between the U.S. and Japan, it's $3.97. Remember that the Japanese prices are quoted as liquid before regasification, where prices elsewhere are always as gas, so they're a different kind of measure. And this simply shows you start out in the left, and you look at the Henry Hub price, you build it up with liquefaction, transportation, regasification, and in theory, a 274 price at Henry Hub is in equilibrium with 795 in Rotterdam. The actual price was only a bit higher. Now, if you take it back to gutter, the interesting thing is the transportation distance between Rotterdam and Tokyo are almost the same from gutter. So it ought to be, the liquid value ought to be the same thing in Japan that it is in Rotterdam. It's much higher. In Japan, the actual price ex-ship was $16.66. The Asian premium, which is the thing that is vulnerable to attack, was $7 of that difference. The typical Japanese pricing clause is based on a very simple formula. It is linked to the Japanese customs cleared price for crude oil, JCC, commonly known as the Japanese crude cocktail. It is in the form of P, price in dollars per million BTUs, is equal to a constant C, expressed in dollars per million BTUs, plus a coefficient known as a slope, multiplied times the Japanese crude price. Now, the discounting is often done in competition by changing the slope or changing the constant. But because the formula is simple and uniform, what you get is various competitors sitting around and trying to figure out what their competitor's slope is to the fourth decimal place. Very little ability to introduce commodity competition into that formulation. Northwest Europe has benefited from the price competition that was unleashed by the LNG surge in 2010. Their LNG arbitrage, together with North Sea commodity competition, exported weak North American prices to the continent through the open access EU pipeline system, and it undermined oil linkage. No similar price competition has been possible in Asia because there's no access to commodity gas. Monopoly companies, long-term contracts for pipeline or LNG, you do not have the commodity competition of the North Sea or North America. And so, essentially, Asia has not been able to take advantage as Europe has. Am I running too long, Charlie? Give me a little bit more. Okay. Most common type of a contract is what's called the delivery ex ship, in which the seller has a destination. He figures out what the pricing and price clause in a destination ex ship contract is, essentially the market pricing. And essentially, if you're going to Japan, you worry about JCC. There are also FOB contracts in which you figure out what the value is in Japan, and you may deduct the transportation cost. The North American contract, the U.S. contracts, are all unique in that they are FOB contracts, but they're priced at origin, not at destination, which introduces a totally different dimension into the contracting structure. And that's their appeal to the oil-linked contract buyers. And this simply says, this takes the 2012 spread and shows you the economic rent between what the costs would be and what the price would be. And if you have a traditional contract, the rent and the price risk goes to the seller. If you have the U.S. contract, the rent and the price risk goes to the buyer. Projects destined for Japan require export authorization from the DOE and a certificate from FERC. Five Japanese contracts represent 19% of the DOE-approved capacity, but none of that capacity as of the end of the last year has a FERC certificate, although almost all of it is in a Freeport contract, that project that is about to be offered a certificate. So most of it is secured. The IEA has not been optimistic about long-term gas demand. In World Energy Outlook 2013, it sees a slight decrease to 2020, followed by limited growth to 2025. Thus, the opportunity for further U.S. imports depends on expiration of current contracts. This is expected to occur significantly in 2019-2021. The gradual emergence of a buyer's market in Japan should give it better bargaining position for contract renewals and for new supplies. And this simply shows the array of projects, 22 projects with all that potential capacity, the projects that have been contracted for, projects that have been approved by the DOE, projects that so forth. But here are the destination of the contracts. Much of the contracts that have been made are portfolio supply, in which a company like Shell, a company like Total, BG, buys the stuff itself and can take it anywhere it wants to, as the market dictates. And this is simply an outline of Japanese LNG commitments out to 2025, showing the possible contracts from the U.S. The history shows where the stuff has come from, and you can see how Fukushima forced Japan heavily into the spot market, but is now building up contract commitments underneath that. And so essentially the U.S. stuff begins to phase in, and there is very little room for a period of time for additional supply before the contract expirations open up and you've got a more competitive market. In conclusion, Japan faces serious energy cost challenges as it attempts to de-emphasize coal and nuclear in favor of expensive imported LNG. Imports of low-cost U.S. shale gas thus have a powerful appeal. And while the present price spread between U.S. and Japanese prices may be unrealistically large, some spread will remain. Thus, a major appeal of U.S. imports is the ability to introduce commodity price competition into the high-priced and structurally rigid traditional oil-linked pricing formula. Thank you.
Thank you very much. My name is Hidehiro Muramatsu. I'm General Manager of Washington, D.C. office of JOGMEC, Japan Oil, Gas, and Metals National Corporation. Today, it is my great honor and pleasure to speak here in the prestigious Brookings Institution and in the presence of the Mr. Tanaka, former Secretary General of the International Energy Agency. Before I touch upon energy situation in Japan, I would like to introduce a little bit about our organization. What is JOGMEC? JOGMEC is Japan Oil, Gas, and Metals National Corporation, and established in 2004 after the merger between the Japan National Oil Corporation and the Metal Mining Agency of Japan, which both are governmental organization. Now we are called it as incorporated administrative agency. Both are under the authority of Ministry of Economy, Trade and Industry, and 100% financed by the Ministry of Finance. And the capital is 502 billion yen, almost equivalent to 5 billion US dollars. And our mission is secure stable supply of natural gas, oil, coal, mineral resources, including rare metals and rare earth, and geothermal energy. And today I especially put emphasis on oil and gas upstream investment and research and development. This map indicates the current project going on throughout the world, supported by the JOGMEC. JOGMEC provides equity capital in total 41 projects, and also provide the liability guarantee to the 13 projects throughout the world. Four projects are in Canada and three projects in Australia. Since 1967, when Japan National Oil Corporation was established, JOGMEC or JNOC provided equity capital to 336 projects all over the world. So maybe this slide is very familiar with you. This slide is, I cite from the IEA website. Japan is highly dependent on the import of natural resources. In the future, there is no move from the upper side of, this picture. Crude oil, we imported almost 100%. Precisely speaking, 99.6% we imported from the mainly from the Middle East, and the LPG 75.8%. LPG is also essential energy for our economy, because almost half of the household, approximately 25 million households, are dependent on LPG for cooking and heating. And also rare metals, almost 100% dependent on overseas supply. This map indicates the our main supplier of LNG. Number one supplier is Australia. It exports 262 billion cubic feet, representing 18.2% of Japanese import in 2012. And the second supplier is Qatar from Middle East. It exported 252 billion cubic feet, representing 17.9%. And the third supplier is Malaysia. It exported 202 billion cubic feet, representing 16.8%. And the fourth is Russia. Russian Federation exported 399 billion cubic feet, representing 9.5%. And the number five in Indonesia, 297 billion cubic feet, representing 7.1%. So these are the traditional and conventional source of LNG suppliers to Japan. This picture is already mentioned, James. In order to avoid a misunderstanding, Japan's import LNG price, including almost $3 of freight and transportation cost and $3 of liquefaction cost. So if the U.S. Henry Hub price is hovering around $3.2 to $4, it plus $6 added to our to the U.S. Natural gas prices. So that the Japanese imported natural gas price is linked to the normally crude oil exported from the Middle East. So we called it the Japan crude cocktail, and we also called it the Japan premium. So this bar chart representing our LNG import. As everybody mentioned, that after Fukushima Daiichi nuclear disaster in 2011, we observed a surge, a sharp surge of the new, LNG import. In 2010, around 70 million tons of import, but in 2012, almost 87 million tons of LNG was exported to Japan. And the important thing is on the right-hand side, currently in 2012, we import our LNG import value amounted to $62 billion U.S. dollars. And in 2012, our trade deficit amounted to $78 billion U.S. dollars. Maybe almost 80% was occupied by the LNG export. So currently, as for the nuclear power plant, there are 50 nuclear power reactors in Japan, which provide approximately 50 gigawatts of power generation and representing 30% of the total electricity supply. And by the end of this last year, seven electricity companies filed the application for the resumption of the nuclear power reactors for the nine sites, and in totaling 16 nuclear power reactors. But as I mentioned, there are 50 nuclear power reactors, but only 16 nuclear power reactors have filed for the resumption for the application. And out of 16, two are filed the last December, so it will take more time. And currently, Nuclear Regulation Authority is reviewing these applications, but toward the end of this March. But I think there will still more time to entirely review this resumption application. And last week, January 10th, Japanese Cabinet Secretary Mr. Suga announced that the postpone of the reviewing the current energy policy framework. Government of Japan, especially the Agency of Natural Resources and Energy, is reviewing the current energy policy framework, but there's still there is a huge discussion about how to treat the nuclear power plant's future. So it will take more time, maybe toward the end of this February. So this is a new opportunity for LNG export from U.S. and Canada and in Russian Federation from the East Siberia, Sakhalin. We already imported from the Sakhalin Islands of the LNG and East Africa, especially Mozambique. There will be a new source of LNG to Japan. Finally, I briefly touch up on our new resource or new source of energy, methane hydride offshore production test. JOGMEC has succeeded in production of the methane hydride in the Nankai Trough of Pacific Ocean. We conducted the first test of 6 days and producing 120,000 cubic meters. And we are now seeking for the opportunity to collaboration and cooperation with the DOE. And we are planning to conduct the onshore methane hydride production test in the state of Alaska. Maybe the time is expired, so this is my presentation today. Thank you very much for listening.
My name is Shoji Ito. I'm a senior analyst at the Institute of Energy Economics, Japan IEJ. I'm so glad and honored to be back at my old home, the Brookings. Thank you very much, Charlie and Alisa, for inviting me to join this very timely event. And, well, I'll be asked to talk at the last panel of the poll. And it's quite easy to say that. Well, everything is just discussed, but I have to say something else. But I'm going to say that I get the opportunity to talk more about geopolitics of the energy security. And actually, I'm teaching a course on energy security in Tokyo, and I'm always teaching my students. I'm telling my students that energy security is such a concept that can be manageable. No, everyone talks about different aspects of energy security. So it's such a big jigsaw puzzle. You can have as many pieces as you want in the package. And we tend to forget about, you know, what we ourselves are talking about energy security. Some people are talking about security of, energy availability, the stability of markets, et cetera. But for somebody else, it means energy plus security. So this is a completely different dimension, but both dimensions are intertwined. We have to know both dimensions. And I think what is happening in terms of US-Japan alliance against the backdrop of shale revolution today is a perfect example of what we mean by energy security. Let me kick off. Well, I think today we have three specific strategic drivers to strengthen the bilateral alliance against the backdrop of shale revolution. One is increasing new opportunities for hydrocarbon trades. I'm saying in plural form hydrocarbons. Well, it's already clear by now. Mike talked about oil, and Jim talked about LNG, and I'll talk a little bit about coal as well. And, well, second, we should also focus upon the importance of gradual shift of the gravity of hydrocarbon flows. Well, actually, we saw some slides already, but let me address this point a little more. And thirdly, I'd like to shed light on the increasing importance of Alaska. Well, Mr. Mamata already talked about what is happening in Japanese energy market against, in the aftermath of the Fukushima disaster, so I wasn't going into details, but just a brief review of that. The LNG import for Japan became all the more important with the reduction of nuclear power in the energy mix. In the age when gas demand is beginning to skyrocket in Asia, specifically led by China, and to be followed by India in the decades to come, well, then Japanese companies have already signed up for a total amount of the approximately 15 million tons of energy import from the lower 48, although these projects must go through FERC's approval in the end. But if these projects come online as scheduled, as planned, it means a lot, because this amount is already an equivalent of 17% of the total import of 2012. Look, we will elaborate the question on Alaska later on. As of 2012, the share of America with LNG coming from Alaska was only 0.3. But we are expecting that the share of the state will go up to at least 17% or hopefully more in a matter of time. And, well, Jim already elaborated the pricing dimension of this issue, so I don't go into the details. But one thing I'd like to say is that most people, including energy experts, tend to pay exclusive, almost exclusive attention for the future of the gas pricing mechanism. But as I already noted, this particular geographical shift of gas flow to Japan means a lot. Well, why is the case? Does anyone know what is happening at the Capitol Hill at this moment? The House Committee on Foreign Relations are holding a hearing on South and East China Seas just this moment. Well, we never know what may happen to the all sorts of geopolitical geopolitically sensitive sea lanes of communication, starting from the Strait of Hormuz, cutting across the Strait of Malacca, going through South and Eastern Seas. Well, as far as LNG import for the states are concerned, they are basically free from supply disruption. It means a lot. Well, next. Well, oil demand is also surging, led by China mainly, and as my colleagues already noted more than once, Japan is dependent upon the Middle East for approximately 90% of its imports. Well, today here in Washington, people are starting to debate about the future possible lift of a ban on the crude oil exports. We don't know the results, but still, as Mike noted, U.S. is increasing the amount of oil products. So what is happening is actually contributing to the stability of our Asian oil market. And at first, U.S. is ready to export more. Asian market right there. Next, coal. Well, as far as coal is concerned, many people actually have a kind of stereotyped image of coal as something dirty. Well, it depends how you use it. We tend to forget about the robust fact that we have clean coal technologies. Against the backdrop of shale gas revolution in the United States, U.S. got a bunch of coal to exports at cheap prices, and actually Japan and China are two of the biggest beneficiaries, along with Germany in Europe. And, well, the Washington is now trying to find out a way to build a much larger framework in Asia, including ASEAN countries, Northeast Asian countries, in terms of projecting, reprojecting U.S. presence in that region. And, well, I think energy can be one of the tangible tools, and then we shouldn't forget about the importance of coal. Unlike oil and gas, coal reserves are located sparsely in many countries, in many regions, without using effectively the coal they have in Asia, including India, China, and elsewhere. The future energy market of Asia will face lots of problems. Then U.S. and Japan should be proud of having clean coal technologies. We are leaders, including Japanese makers like Toshiba, Hitachi, Mitsubishi. They have very good, very much advanced clean coal technologies. I think it is high time to make a good combination. And they can be applied in the U.S. as well. However cheap gas prices have become, coal still accounts for considerable share of U.S. power mix. We shouldn't forget about it. So we can develop coal cooperation both inside and outside the United States of America. Well, let me start to talk about the importance of Alaska. Well, actually, Alaska was the first place which began to export LNG to Japan. Back in 1969, people tend to forget about it. But As you already saw the slide, a couple of slides behind, Alaska today accounts for only 0.3% of Japan's LNG imports. Well, Alaska has massive amount of oil and gas reserves. They have recently lost, well, they are starting to lose, quickly speaking, domestic market in the lower 48 because of the shale revolution here. But what is happening in that part of the world, in the North Pacific West? Russia is trying to project its influence along the Arctic Sea. China just sent icebreaker to hit Arctic water some years ago. I'm not saying something serious will happen. I don't think it will be the case so easy, but one thing I can say is uncertainties are increasing. Then the question is, Alaska is located at the bridgehead of U.S. Asian policy. Do you think it's a good idea to leave the development of Alaska untouched for the decades to come? I don't think so. Well, this slide shows what I already mentioned, actually. And I think Alaska can be a great example and place where Japan can, you know, find new investing opportunities. You know, we can diversify routes of imports, both of crude oil and LNG down the road. Well, I just got the slide from the latest version of AEO 2014, and I just blocked here in red. Well, since time is limited, I should be brief. But I'd like to say that, well, I think this is really a sweet spot. Japan and the U.S. can do something together. I got a message from the slide that at first we leave the Alaskan hydrocarbon development business as usual. All private sector has no reason to hurry up because they can make better deals in the lower 48. They have many other places. Alaska, to develop Alaska, you have to overcome tremendous difficulties, environmental questions. They have to find reserves under permafrost. How difficult it is. I know that. I actually lived in Russian Siberia for 3 years, and I arrived in Washington, D.C. last Monday, and everyone asked me whether, you know, how I felt of the, you know, unusual weather. Well, I just told them I used to live in a place temperature was much colder than last Monday and Tuesday. I survived. Well, anyhow, it cost a lot. So someone must make lead money, lead investment to boost the development of Alaskan oil and gas potential. Let me conclude with this slide. Well, I'd like to re-emphasize the importance of energy security as a vehicle to improve Japan's energy security condition in terms of reduction of market volatility, diversification of hydrocarbon supply routes, etc. And second, once again, when we talk about what is happening in the Pacific dimension against shale revolution, against the backdrop of shale revolution, we should also talk about security implications of energy cooperation or project, whatever you call it. And lastly, and once again, I think what we are discussing today here is such a good leverage or method to think about what you, how and how the U.S. can project or stabilize its influence in the Asia Pacific, when meanwhile people are starting to talk about increasing opportunities of energy independence and their rebalancing to Asia. And it is really high time for both Washington and Tokyo how we could ever boost the bilateral tie. We shouldn't forget about that. No other single alliance has persisted as long as U.S.-Japan alliance, historically speaking. And we have to keep strengthening it for many decades to come. Thank you very much for your attention.
I want to thank all the panelists for what I thought was an engaging presentation by all of them. But I must say, Soichi, I think your geopolitical view of the U.S. wishes to pivot to Asia, which supposedly we're already doing, I don't think we've begun to see the opportunities for energy cooperation that you highlighted. And you kind of reminded me of Jim Schlesinger many years ago, who I think also had a strategic vision somewhere along the lines you're advocating. In the interest of saving as much time for the audience as possible, I'm not going to address 4 points that I have for people to answer, but perhaps some of these issues may come up in the questions they answer from the floor. Mike, I think your presentation was extremely interesting, but it raised in my own mind a vexing question. If it's the U.S. production that has been responsible for keeping oil prices relatively stable, what happens to the unconventional oil and gas revolution if all of a sudden by a wave of the wand or some miraculous event, we actually had Iran re-enter the family of nations and got Western technology in there? Somehow we got Iraq stabilized and the other countries you mentioned. What are the prospects that we could actually see energy prices fall down to a level where they might actually hurt some of the high-cost unconventional oil and gas investments? And Mr. Muramatsu, you have a very interesting chart on where LNG was coming. I noticed that you had a very bullish view of the Canadian situation, which obviously Soichi would like to see come to fruition as well. But we all know the reality of the Canadian situation is unfortunately still somewhat mired in domestic politics in British Columbia. And I just was wondering, during the questions from the floor, if you might be able to work in some remarks on what you see needs to be done to galvanize Canada. And Jim, you raised the vexing question of how the international gas market was changing. But I was also wondering if, in your view, do you see the Northern Sea Route as being a viable opportunity to dramatically cut costs from the European market to the Asian market, and might that bring about some narrowing of the overall international gas price, which you tend to be, I think, somewhat skeptical of? And finally, Soichi, in your remarks, particularly those relating to security of supply, I'm always puzzled when Japan talks about security of supply from LNG, and you certainly are talking about security of supply for oil also. And yet with 80% of Japan's energy coming from the Middle East, or oil coming from the Middle East and a substantial portion of gas, is it really a diversification of energy sources that Japan is most interested in, mm-hmm. or is it more a diversification of the supply, of the location of those supplies? Mm-hmm. I was glad to hear you talk about lifting the ban on crude oil from the United States, because clearly that, I think, would be in a great interest. But most importantly, I think this idea you put forward, and particularly, again, with the changing conditions in the Arctic, the idea that we could well see a Japan, United States, Canadian relationship centered on Alaska and northwestern Canada mm-hmm. is an idea who we may say whose time has not yet come, but it may not be far away. So with those few remarks, let me turn to the floor and we'll take questions. If you would address it, identify yourself and address your question to a particular panelist, that would be appreciated. Any questions from the floor? Surely after those stimulating presentations, we have some questions. Yes, sir. We have a mic coming up.
Thank you very much. My name is Shinichi Sobe with CSS Japan Chair, originally from the Japanese government organization called JETRO. I think this question goes to the speakers from the United States. Is there any possibility that the law restricting the automatic LNG export to non-FTA country be repealed or modified in the near future? Because as Mr. Ito mentioned, some lawmakers are even starting the argument of lifting the ban of U.S. crude oil exports. So I thought there might be some chance about this argument. Thank you.
Obviously, there is a conflict of, or a debate in the U.S. over whether to permit exports altogether. And an industrial group, largely led by Dow Chemical, was saying, let's keep our advantages at home, let's not export. They gradually conceded a level that they could probably live with. We're probably at that level right now, which basically says that maybe we ought to put the lid on the thing after all. So the debate is heated up again, no question about that. I know that. My view is that the DOE is not going to determine how many exports are made from the United States. The market will do it. And my view of the market is that we are pretty close to saturation of what can be bought from the U.S. out to 2025. And so my view is let it rip. It won't hurt. But that point of view, there are those who don't agree with that. And so obviously, and it's a source of debate. I was over at the Department of Energy this morning, and that's exactly what they're talking about. So, you know, it's you can't rule it out. But I would say one other thing. There is another hurdle that has to be passed, and that's the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission with certificate authority. That's a very complicated adversarial process, can be very time-consuming, and you really have to justify you have a serious project to survive. Mm-hmm. DOE may say yes, FERC may not say yes. And so I think there are limits, there are natural limits to how fast it will grow.
Mike, do you want to add anything?
Well, were you talking about the removal of the FTA wrinkle in this? I don't know. I haven't heard any appetite for that discussion. I think
I'm sorry. Okay, yeah, right.
Most of the firepower, I think, is going to go into the discussion about crude oil exports. Mm-hmm. The next hot button, I think, will be, and I think it will make the LNG discussion look easy. When we start talking about crude oil exports.
If I could follow up on that, is it your understanding that if the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement is implemented, that LNG would be included in that, and so de facto we would be lifting the ban with anyone who's part of that agreement?
I'm not a trade lawyer, so lawyers can make anything look different. But what I was told by somebody was that's written into the TPA or the agreement arrangements that would make that a moot point in terms of the LNG. you know, sharp lawyers can make it sound like it's not an FTA, and we've got more than our share of sharp lawyers. So, but I think there's something written in this agreement that would actually make that a moot point.
Yes, ma'am. Down in the middle. Can we get her a mic, please?
DDP.
Thank you. My name is Reba Carruth from Georgetown University. I have a two-part question. The first part is for our two distinguished panelists from the U.S., and the second part is for our distinguished panelists from Japan. Okay, the first part, Mexico announced the deregulation of Pemex a couple of weeks ago, and at the Atlantic Council, the issue of the movement towards a North American energy system was heavily discussed by the American and Mexican panelists. So I would like to know how you see the evolution of not just a U.S.-Canadian framework, but a truly North American framework with a lot of opportunity for expanded market growth and supply, and how you see that playing out in terms of what's evolving now in the Pacific region, but also globally. The second part is for our distinguished panelists from Japan. The EU and the U.S. have an Energy Council, which is very quietly and rapidly working on the evolution of a global market for energy with rules, with regulatory standards, and looking to the future when maybe everyone is not cooperative in terms of how markets should be working, you know, how this anarchy in an international system can play out relative to energy and oil and gas. So I'd like to get your view on how Japan is watching this evolution and where you think this should go. Thank you.
I think the answer on the Mexico-U.S. side is we already do have a U.S.-Mexico continental marketplace. you know, we export oil products, we export natural gas, we import Mexican crude. The only disconnect there is the investment side. The U.S., you know, foreign companies cannot invest up until now, and we'll wait and see what the rules are for that because there's still a lot to be done. We can't invest there. They can invest here. So that's the one big barrier. But otherwise, in terms of trade, we essentially have a continental market all the way from Alaska down to, you know, Central America.
I would make a comment that, I mean, it's harder for the international community to invest in Mexico than it is to invest in China or Russia. Essentially, Mexico is probably the most retrograde place for foreign investment in oil and gas. They're in a position right now watching north of the border some of the same geology. We are talking about exports. Their crude production is going down the tubes very fast, and they're importing a lot of natural gas. And finally, that is beginning to percolate through, and the idea of liberalizing it and taking advantage of international capital and know-how is coming forth. I think Mexico is going to reverse its bad decline, but it won't be a big exporter, but it'll take some of the burden off the import system.
One of you want to start on the Japan question?
As for the transatlantic dialogue on energy between the United States and the European Union, I was once Director General of the Moscow Office of Japan National Oil Corporation. And since that, I see the situation in the European market and the Russian Federation. Maybe you know that there is a huge dispute of the natural gas export through mm-hmm. the pipeline from the Russia through the European Union. There is this disruption in the Ukraine. So Russian Federation is now looking for the opportunity to export their natural gas as a form of LNG to the Asian Pacific market. And also the European Union looking for the opportunity to import mm-hmm. fossil fuel outside the Russia or Middle East. And maybe you know that United States coal miners are already seeking for the opportunity to export coking coal and thermal coal to the European market. Mm-hmm. And the LNG exporter such as Cheniere They are now planning to export the LNG to the British gas, and also the Freeport LNG is looking for the opportunity to export the LNG to the BP. So energy tie between the U.S. and Europe will contribute to the stability and the security of the European energy situation. So that is a very good idea. And also the, now we Japanese government is looking for the dialogue with vis-a-vis the Department of Energy. Now the scope of discussion is limited in renewable energy, but I think in the future we will have to discuss on the LNG export and the LPG export and also the crude oil export that they mentioned, and also the nuclear technology, non-proliferation, and other things. I think it's a good idea for the future.
You want
anything
to add?
Well, actually, Mr. Mamat's already explained in greatest details. So, you know, just a brief comment. I think you raised a very important point. I think it's very timely. And it's not quite easy to establish some kind of new institution, but this is something we have down the road. And we have some seeds for that, as Mama-san already mentioned. Yeah.
If I may just add, there is a potential downside if we lifted the ban on crude oil exports because of the configuration of our refineries. You might well see that some of the Mexican crude that currently comes in the United States would lose a market, and whether that would potentially create any rancor in our bilateral relations is at least something to keep in mind. Yes, ma'am. Got a question up front if we have a mic?
Thank you. Jenny Mandel with Energy Wire, and I have a question mainly for the Japanese presenters. About the LNG Buyers Club. So periodically we hear updates that there are some countries that are working together in Asia to try and increase the market force of the Asian buyers. So I wonder if you can give an update on that and also a bit of a sense of how the competitive pressures between those countries play out versus the collaborative interest in working together on this issue. And what kind of timeline there could be for that group to make a difference in the Asian pricing schemes. Thank you.
I'm not familiar with the pricing scheme of the LNG at this moment, but of course, maybe you know that the Japanese LNG importers are trying to the seeking for the new formula of the LNG price formula. Detached from the Japan crude cocktail. As you know, the Cheniere has already fixed the LNG export price at 50% plus of the Henry Hub prices. I think that Japanese buyers are trying to seek this kind of a new formula. But in the future, I think there is a convergence of the price differentials between the LNG linked to the Japan crude cocktail and the LNG price linked to the Henry Hub prices. But we will see.
Yes, I come across the same question, you know, where I travel nowadays. Yes, what you call buyer's club has attracted so much attention globally. And first, it is true that our major LNG consumers, including Japan, ROK, China, India, even Taiwan, you know, sharing the interest in common to buy cheaper, you know, LNG, because they are basically buying crude oil-linked LNG, as GB elaborated already. And second, having said that, though, it's not easy to come up with something very, very tangible. They have the same goal, aim, regardless of the fact that, as everyone knows, China, Japan, and Korea are facing lots of political tensions, historical problems, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When the issue comes to this specific question of buying cheap LNG by way of bringing about a change in gas pricing mechanism, they have the same goal, no problem at all, to collaborate. But it's easy to say so. But it's just too early to say when and how we can do it. I think this is at most I can tell at this moment.
Jim, did you want to add anything? Nope. We have a question in the back.
Hi, Alex Benedetto with SNL Energy. This question, I guess, is more for James. In the U.S., the industry has been generally focused more on East Coast, Gulf Coast LNG export projects, and some say the West Coast LNG export projects have taken a bit of a backseat. But given the global LNG market is going to be driven from Asia, what are your thoughts on the future of these U.S. West Coast LNG export projects?
Okay. They're very different. The traditional LNG project is based on stranded gas. Essentially, it is a gas field wherever found that does not have a market unless you invest in field development, you invest in the transportation to get it to the coast, the liquefaction plant, the tankers. That's why you have a long-term contract, because you're not going to invest in the chain unless you basically know that you've got a market and you've got a reliable price. As I've indicated, essentially the Gulf Coast projects are very different. All you're investing in, your contract, really is a tolling agreement. It says the gas is going to be there. You don't worry about it. I mean, you don't want the helium carbon price to go up, but you don't worry about supply. It's a commodity. And so you're investing in a much smaller part of the thing. Now, when you go to British Columbia, and I'll start there, there is a small pipeline link up to the Montney and the Horn River shales, far too small to support a pipeline down to Kitimat in British Columbia. So essentially, the British Columbia projects are essentially traditional projects in which you're trying to put enough to justify investment in the field, the pipeline, and everything together. And so they're not going to be very comfortable with the kind of commodity competition I'm talking about. Now, when you talk about Jordan Cove or LNG or Oregon LNG, you're kind of neither fish nor fowl. You don't have a commodity in Washington and Oregon. You don't have a pipeline linked to the Montney, and you may be able to build a pipeline to the to the Rocky Mountains for some surplus gas. But if that's the case, again, it's a stranded gas project. So they're a very different beast. And, I mean, I freely confess I'm skeptical about them, but I've been proved wrong a lot of these judgments, and I may be, but that's... Remember, they're different.
If you've ever been involved trying to get a big industrial energy project built on the California, Oregon, Washington coast, yeah, I have. You know, I mean, I work with trying to get regas terminals built. A little more than a decade ago, you cannot get something like that permitted built on the West Coast, or at least it seems almost impossible. So. Whether or not it's stranded gas, all these other issues, I don't care what kind of gas you got. I could go through chapter and verse of different places to try to do this.
I promised Mr. Jensen we would be out of here at 3:30 since he has a flight, so I think we have time for one more question, perhaps. Right here. From the Russians.
Well, thank you for your very detailed presentations. My name is Evgeny Shumilov. I'm from the Russian embassy. And the question, I believe, is mainly for Mr. Herberg. In your presentation, you mentioned that quasi-energy self-sufficiency of the United States. And if so, if the United States is unable to meet its energy demand in the near future, wouldn't that hinder the substantial supplies for potential buyers of energy resources, including Japan? Thank you.
Well, I think what we're talking about is we export light crude, which we have increasingly in surplus, and then we import, you know, the heavier grades, which the whole Gulf Coast refining system has spent the last 20 years investing in, because that was supposedly the balance of global crude was going to become heavier. So in any event, we will be a net importer in the U.S. out to 2020 plus. But it's more about allowing the natural trade to operate, and it has various price effects and products and other things that would actually be very beneficial for U.S. consumers. But we'll remain a net crude importer for quite a while, but that doesn't negate the value of actually allowing crude exports.
Charlie, you asked one question about the Northern Sea Route.
Yes.
Let me answer that. I'm very interested in trying to figure out the economics of that, and I'll tell you the information is very sparse. But I can tell you that in September, you would save 25 cents going the Northern Sea Route from the Yamal Peninsula to Japan versus going through Suez. Mm-hmm. Having watched a Russian research vessel trapped in Antarctic ice, I don't know what it would cost in January.
Good answer. I want you to join me in thanking all the panelists for...